when we did the variational principle on our Einstein action, we got the term we wanted, which was a bulk or volume Einstein tensor, integral of an Einstein tensor, but our boundary term was a little bit non-standard from the perspective of variational principle because it doesn't involve delta G, it involves derivatives of delta G. In other words, normal derivatives of delta G, which means if we have our manifold, and this is our delta M here, it's using information about G that's near to the boundary. So it's not to set this boundary term to zero, we have to do more than to assume delta G is zero on the boundary. We have to assume things about delta G near to the boundary. So that seems atypical of a variational principle approach to doing equations of motion. The other thing I pointed out was that if we were going to try and do some sort of action approach or quantum gravity type approach, we would want to have an exponential of the Euclidean action. And if we do that, there are a whole host of very interesting solutions that are Ricci flat. And so again, naively, they would have vanishing Einstein-Hilbert action. So we don't really want different physical solutions to be degenerate like that. And so that's yet another motivation for thinking about having a boundary term. However, there's another route we could have taken. In a lot of applications of gravity, we're often interested in solutions that are lower dimensional. So these tend to get called brains, and they crop up quite a lot in supergravity solutions to low-energy string theory. And so in that sense, it's also useful for us to have a prescription or a sort of methodology for dealing with submanifolds because we have these lower dimensional objects living in a higher dimensional space-time. So that's a different reason for thinking about submanifolds, but the route we've taken is thinking about the gravitational action. So what I'm going to do first is talk a little bit about the mathematics of submanifolds. So we'll derive geometric quantities that describe the embedding of the submanifold. And then I'll come back to thinking about this boundary term, and we'll define about a boundary integral that we're going to add to the gravitational action. So I'm going to take the dimension of my big manifold, it to be capital D, and the dimension of my submanifold to be little n. So by submanifold, I just mean that if I just knew about sigma itself, it would be a manifold in the sense that we know. So our picture here is something like this. Our way of visualizing is, as always, to think about our cubed normal three-dimensional space. And so it might be a surface living in three-dimensional space. So that's kind of the intuition that we're going to carry with us. Now, in general, we're going to have normals to that surface. And if we are in, you know, in an arbitrary number of dimensions with an arbitrary dimensional submanifold, they're going to be more than one normal. So we define what we call our codimension, which is kind of the obvious thing of our submanifold, which is the number of dimensions that are in our manifold, but not in our submanifold. So the codimension is just the dimensionality of the cover or big manifold minus the dimensionality of sigma. what the number, the codimension is literally the number of linearly independent normals to the surface. And so we imagine that we coordinatize our surface by a set of intrinsic coordinates, sigma A. So here my capital A runs from 1 to n, little n. And I can essentially at any point P, I'm going to have tangent vectors to sigma, which are given by these coordinate functions. And then I'm going to have some more vectors lying in TP of M that do not, that have zero projection onto the surface. So that's what this is saying. It's saying it's a normal to the surface. So the other way of seeing this is another way of defining our surfaces by a set of coordinates. So these are my manifold coordinates, and I'm saying that my surface is somehow restricted. We've got a sort of restricted relation on our coordinates, and so these x mu are like x mu of sigma a. So an example of this is a world line where you write x mu of t. So that's an example of a submanifold. It's a one-dimensional submanifold, and it has one coordinate, t, proper time of an observer, and so x mu of t is just an example here. So if we had instead, you know, a string sweeping out a world sheet, that would be x mu of sigma and tau, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, this dx mu by d sigma a is sort of a tangent vector to the manifold because we're going along the coordinate line sigma a, and this is the components of our vector, and so our normals simply have zero contraction with that vector. Okay, so that's kind of set up what we mean by the surface, a little bit of notation. In fact, I'm going to use capital Roman letters to denote the sort of intrinsic indices to the submanifold, and either Latin or Greek, lowercase Latin or Greek letters to denote the manifold indices. So what can we do? Well, obviously, what we want to do is to split things out into stuff that's parallel to our surface and stuff that's normal to the surface. So the first thing we want to do is to try and find what the metric is on our submanifold that it inherits as being part of the underlying big manifold M. So this is sometimes called the first fundamental form of sigma. So what we do is we use these normals that we have to kind of project out the normal degrees of freedom in the metric. So here, this plus or minus is simply keeping track of whether our normal is space-like or time-like. So if you were doing a 3 plus 1 formulation of gravity, in that case, you would have sets. You'd split your manifold up into some sort of foliation of space-like surfaces that, you know, are labeled by the time. So you're kind of taking sheets of paper, splitting up your volume. In that case, your normal would be time-like, and so that would be a minus sign there. Much of what I'm going to be talking about is whether normal is space-like, because I'm thinking of this in terms of, well, I guess it's Euclidean, so it's a bit of a moot point, but in terms of the gravitational action, or if I'm thinking about submanifolds as physical objects, like these brains that I was talking about. If you have a brain, it always has one time-like direction, so any normals are always space-like. So we can think of H as a projection of the metric sort of parallel to sigma. And so this is the metric that our submanifold inherits from the parent manifold. But note that H still lives in the tensor space of M. So it's an element at P. It's an element of TP star tensor TP star, not TP star of sigma. We can, of course, also, if we pretended that we didn't know about M, we could ask, well, what if I were just dealing with my submanifold sigma as a manifold in its own right? Then what would be the metric then in terms of an element of TP star of sigma as opposed to TP star of M? So in other words, we may also want to just think about quantities that are actually intrinsic to sigma. So in this case, dx mu by d sigma a provides us with a way of mapping quantities, either pushing forward or pulling back quantities, onto the tangent space of sigma. So it's kind of doing the obvious thing. Dx by d sigma simply converts space-time indices into submanifold indices. So that tells us our intrinsic metric is fairly straightforward. We take H and we just turn the indices into sigma indices. So that's what we mean by our distance function. We simply take our submanifold, project our metric down onto it, and it gives us some distance function on sigma inherited from n. Yep.
So omega a, you're not writing any distance
vector. Sorry, and this is saying this is the space time, or well, the big manifold covector. This lives, so this lives in TP star of M. This lives in TP star of sigma. And so I'm mapping TP star of M onto TP star of sigma via this relation. I take my one form in TP star of M and I project it down using this projection operator into TP star of sigma. Sorry,
the coordinates in sigma are
A. These sigma are the coordinates on the submanifold, and these x's are the coordinates on the manifold. So the x's are like, you know, the chart, the functions on the chart of the manifold M. The sigmas are the functions on H, some chart of the manifold sigma. Yep.
I just forgot writing the metric.
Yep, sorry. Absolutely right, yep. Got carried away. It's also true, actually, that's just... That's also the case. It's, you know, because the normals are sort of orthogonal to this projection operator here. Okay. It's fairly straightforward, really. This part, it's just saying sigma just, you know, gets its distances from the parent manifold. Now we want to move towards thinking about connections and curvature. And we do this via what's called the second fundamental form. And this is more helpfully known as extrinsic curvature. This is like a sort of derivative of the normal. It's sort of part of the connection in a sense. But it's telling you now about properties of the embedding. The first fundamental form is just telling you about distances. It's not really telling you that much about the embedding, although obviously the embedding's encoded in some sense into the distance function. But extrinsic curvature gives you information about how your surface bends in the manifold. So this is usually the sort of confusion. I think when you first learn about a cylinder and you're told a cylinder is flat, that's sort of the first time you hear that, you think, come on, right? You know, it's not flat, look at it, you know, it's round. But in fact, what we are thinking of as curvature there is this extrinsic curvature. So that is, you know, that's why I think it's a more helpful terminology. It's what we see as things being bent or distorted, because when we look at the space around us, to all intents and purposes, the space around us is flat. So when we screw up a surface like this, what we're really doing is giving it a sort of curved embedding, and that crops up in this extrinsic curvature.
When you mentioned form, it's not a different form.
This is just the terminology. So fundamental form, it is a covector, but it is not a form. So what we do, if I just sketch here now, a surface, which is a line on a plane here. So this is a flat blackboard. So I'm sitting in flat space, but I'm drawing a wobbly line. And so here's my normal. So how do I know that my line has a non-trivial embedding? Well, if I look at what happens to my normal here, if I look at sort of what the change is between this normal and this normal, you see that there's, as your curve, as your line curves round, you get a change in the normal that's kind, in this case, the way I've sketched it, is parallel to the surface. So this would be our sigma, and which is one-dimensional, and our manifold here is the blackboard, which is two-dimensional. So that's just an illustration. And of course, this is living parallel to the manifold, so I can write it as an intrinsic quantity. By simply projecting the covariant derivative of the normal onto the surface. Now here I've introduced this grad n, and this is simply the inherited covariant derivative.
To break it down,
sorry?
In the first line.
That's symmetrization. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm saying V is also somehow parallel to sigma. So that's the second fundamental form, extrinsic curvature, and it's telling us about our sort of the non-triviality of our embedding. So I used this example when I was talking about extrinsic curvature, so we'll just take a look at it. If we think about our cylinder, as an embedding in our cubed, so our cylinder has radius A, and our normal is obviously going to be a radially pointing vector in the xy plane. Now, in this case, we're dealing with Euclidean three-dimensional space. Our metric is delta AB, and our normal is the radial vector, which is cos theta sine theta. So here, if I write in Cartesians, if I write my first fundamental form, this is what I get. So that's just delta minus nn. So we're in Cartesians here. So what I want to illustrate here is the fact that, or I'm emphasizing the difference between the first fundamental form H and the intrinsic metric gamma. Because here, my coordinates x, y, and z are not particularly well adapted to this submanifold, which has a nice sort of symmetric form. So if instead I go into polars, well, in polars, my dr squared would be 1. My d theta squared would be r squared. And my dz squared would be 1. So that's my gab. But then n has just got a single component in the radial direction. And so I subtract 1 off the rr component. So in other words, I get 0. And all I'm left with is this sort of bottom corner. So that's much more intuitive as an induced metric. So I can peel off from this. Some coordinates, I just take the azimuthal angle and the z direction, and my metric, my intrinsic metric, is now a nice, sort of, fairly clear, intuitive form. So my extrinsic curvature again in polars. So in polars, remember my n is just 1, 0, 0, and nr. So kab is going to be minus gamma rab, again in polars. And so this is just the only connection component that I have is gamma r theta theta. And so I just have a single non-zero component of A. So I have extrinsic curvature, but I only have one non-zero component. So that's the sort of obvious set of things that we can define that are directly associated with sigma and quantities living on sigma. So the only other thing I want to mention is about the normals. Yep.
So this extrinsic curvature, is it always smooth necessarily?
Well, we're going to... it depends how you define your embedding and what restrictions you put. From our perspective, because we always deal with C-infinity manifolds, we're basically going to want to deal with submanifolds that are smooth, C-infinity. Now, I guess what we could allow ourselves isolated, sort of little kinks or isolated points at which maybe it's not a smooth embedding. But we have to be a little careful. But from the physics perspective, it's going to be almost always smooth.
Yeah, I was thinking about if you have like a non-orientable surface.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then you might have a problem when you go around.
Yeah, well, I'm always talking about orientable manifolds because, I mean, you know, from our perspective, again, thinking about what we want to define in terms of physics, we're usually dealing, almost always dealing with orientable manifolds. So, but I'm sure that there are, you know, special cases. Is there any... honest answer is, I don't know, because I've never particularly probed. If I've only ever been interested in using it in a case where I'm describing some sort of actual object. So I've always been using it in the context of orientable manifolds. But I guess I'm just, I think the problem I would find with sort of trying to construct a non-orientable submanifold within an orientable manifold is just how that embedding would work. So you might be thinking Möbius strip, but then, you know, that's sort of how do you, you know, that's, you can't have a manifold with an edge, you know, submanifold with an edge, at least not here. So if we have more than one normal, we can also imagine a situation where, you know, here we've taken the parallel component of how the normal is varying. But if I were to think now of a curve in three dimensions instead of two, so let me just take a straight line, I could imagine kind of rotating my normals as I move along the line. So in that particular instance, that's not really corresponding to anything physical, but, you know, there's nothing to stop me from shifting my normals as I move throughout the submanifold. This is going to look silly, but never mind. You could also vary the normals normally in the sense of have a normal variation of the normals. So this gives rise to what are called normal fundamental forms. Which are really just the normal variation of the normals. So we can, if we were to imagine setting up the problem of trying to describe our submanifold, we'd start off with our coordinate sigma on the submanifold and a certain set of normals. I can then extend my coordinates into the space around the submanifold by taking sigma is constant along these normal directions, and I extend the normals off the submanifold, let's say geodesically, so grad n of n is zero. So I'm imagining I can choose the fact that the normal variation, sorry, that the extension of our normal, my normals off the submanifold is geodesic. But what that still doesn't specify for me is whether I've just, you know, been extremely glib and I've allowed my normals to twist as I wander around my submanifold. So you can see that at least locally, this is obviously not actually containing anything physical. This is really about a connection. So this is exactly a sort of gauge, because you're saying that as you move along your submanifold, the normal part of the tangent space is twisting. So there's a sort of non-trivial part of the connection here. That doesn't mean there's any curvature. That would kind of depend on the sort of larger structure of the manifold. So now, if I think about asking a question about curvature, I've got my manifold M, which has some Riemann curvature. I've got the submanifold sigma, which has an intrinsic metric, and I can calculate the intrinsic curvature from the intrinsic metric and metric connection of my submanifold. So the question is, how are these two related? And so that's basically related, which we'll show at least for codimension one by the Gauss equation. So this is really the reason for the handout, the algebra involved in showing this. So here, what this is saying is that you get the Riemann curvature of your submanifold by taking the Riemann curvature of the manifold, projecting basically any index that you find parallel to the submanifold, and then you add or subtract these extrinsic curvature terms. So it's telling you about the sort of splitting up of the connection between the sort of piece that's parallel to the submanifold and the bits that are orthogonal. So K, in some sense, is like part of the connection. And so you can see that these terms here are a bit like the gamma-gamma pieces in the component definition of the Riemann tensor. So that's kind of where it's coming from. So what we'll demonstrate this for codimension one, because that's kind of the easy case. And so it's sort of basically an algebraic argument. You just look at what do you mean by the Riemann tensor and turn the handle. So in this case, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the Riemann identity for a vector that's lying tangent to sigma, tangent to my submanifold. So V is tangent to sigma. So my Riemann tensor for the submanifold is defined via this commutator of covariant derivatives. So I'm just going to be in a coordinate basis here to make things easy. And so all I'm going to do is, here, this is what we're trying to calculate. So I'm going to go in by hand and use the definition of the covariant derivative lying within sigma. So my covariant derivative here, grad C of grad D VA, says take here's my C, D, and A index and project them all parallel to sigma. So it says take the space-time covariant derivative and project it parallel to sigma. And then, of course, I've got to subtract the C swapped with D version. So that's taken the first covariant derivative. Now I've got to go inside my bracket and say, now I've got to replace this second covariant derivative with the definition, which is the, let's just get this. Which simply says contract, project every index parallel to sigma. So this is really a case, and I've forgotten a grad F there. This is really just a case of keeping, you know, a level head through all the algebra. So what I have to do is I have to pull this covariant derivative, the space-time, the M covariant derivative through the H's so that it hits this VQ here. And then my anti-symmetrization on C and D is going to give me a Riemann identity in the higher dimensional manifold acting on V. So that's where I'm going to get my higher dimensional Riemann from. In the meantime, this covariant derivative is also going to hit each of these first fundamental forms. The first fundamental form is, as we saw somewhere, g plus or minus nn. When the covariant derivative hits g, it just gives zero. So in this case, we've got the covariant derivative acting on the two normals. And when it hits a normal, it's going to give us an extrinsic curvature. So that's what we're doing. So in each case, all I've done is I've written out the covariant derivative acting on the three terms. In this case, my HEQ comes out and turns that into an HAQ. And in the other case, we've got an HPG, which turns this into an HPD. Now I look at what I'm taking derivative of. Here, I've got a H PG, which is basically delta PG plus NN. So when the NG comes out, it hits this H and gives me zero. And then when the NP comes out, it gives me a grad N of V, but of course our V is just lying parallel to sigma. So that term is also zero. The top line, the anti-symmetrization on C and D here turns into an anti-symmetrization on F and G, which gives me the Riemann identity acting on V. So good news, that's what I want. So the top line's taken care of. So now all I've got to look at is the bottom line. So let me just write this down. I use my Riemann identity on the first line. And then I've got my plus or minus, except I hope I've got the right signs in here, for the H being G plus or minus NN. So when I hit the covariant derivative of NENQ, the only derivative that counts is the derivative of NE, because if I take the derivative of NQ, the NE comes out and hits that first term. So what I end up with is simply an extrinsic curvature piece here, and then an N grad PV. But this term here is equal to minus VQ grad P NQ, because N and V are orthogonal. So I've just relabeled my indices here so that it sort of matches what I wrote down for the Gauss equation. And then the second term here, we see that this is just going to give me another extrinsic curvature piece. So KEF turns into KAC, KBD. And I get my KK term. So it was just sort of fairly lengthy bit of algebra, but it's simply showing just how you derive it. It's saying that, you know, your Riemann tensor projects down, but you also have to take into account the extra bits of the connection that come from the embedding. So you now see the reason why the cylinder is Ricci flat, because there's only, if we look at the top, there's only one non-zero component of K. So any anti-symmetrization of products of K is always going to vanish, because the only way KK can be non-zero is if it precisely hits that single component. And so you have to have basically the A and C and B and D indices all the same, and so the KK terms cancel each other out, and there's no Riemann curvature in R cubed, so that means the intrinsic Riemann curvature of the cylinder is zero. So now I want to go back to this problem that we set up at the end of last lecture and to see what we can do. Can we construct a boundary term? Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that a Ricci curved fat manifold cannot be embedded in a larger Ricci flat manifold?
No, it just means you've got to distort it more. I mean, the cylinder only is curved in one of its two directions, that's it. It's curved, XY plane, it's a circle, but in the Z direction, it's absolutely straight, okay? We know because S2, we draw it as an embedding in R3. R3 is completely flat, S2 is not. So in that case, your extrinsic curvature will have components both in the theta and the phi directions. So you get non-trivial combination of the k's in that case. So what I want to do now, in small number of minutes remaining, is to construct a boundary term. So the obvious scalar to try is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Now I'm going to demonstrate that this actually does cancel off this problematic term here by choosing, I'm going to sort of be specific about what I'm going to choose. So I have a normal I'm going to choose my normal to be normalized, be a unit normal. And I'm going to extend it geodesically into the bulk. I'm just saying this because this is, it's a choice of gauge. I'm setting up my coordinates. I'm setting up my vectors. This is simply a choice of gauge, but it just makes the calculations a little bit more convenient. So what that means is that grad n of n is equal to 0. Now, I'm going to take n also to be space-like. So actually, I should have put minus 1 there. And I'm going to calculate the variation of this boundary term. So first things first, HAB is G plus NN. And then I'm going to just derive a few relations that I'm going to need. So I'm going to assume that under a variation, my gauge is preserved. So the change in the length of n is 0. So that gives me an expression for the normal component of delta n in terms of the metric. Now, remember, this is sort of, whenever I write delta G here, it's really delta G inverse. And when I write delta NA upstairs, that really is the variation of the vector components of N. The other thing is, of course, that n is normal to the boundary. So that means that under a variation, n should still be normal to the boundary. And so you get something a bit similar that says if there's a non-zero contraction of delta n with h, then, and my indices are all over the place. You do that to emphasize that's delta of H inverse. Then, okay, that's what I have to, you know, I mean, normally you would say that n dot delta h was 0, but I'm just writing this down. Finally, just by rearranging the definition of my first fundamental form, I've obviously got this relation between delta n, delta H and delta G. I can track that with an N, and then I'm going to rearrange. So here I'm going to use this relation here to substitute for that n dot with delta h to replace that with an h delta n. And then you see here what I've got is h minus nn, which is just g. So this is simply equal to delta n minus delta na plus nb delta gab, or my variation of my normal, I've managed now to express it in terms of the variation of the metric. So that's really because delta H, delta N, and delta G are not all independent. So if I sort of choose to focus on delta H and delta G, I need to be able to express delta N in terms of them. So for my variational problem, I want to know what delta K is. And K is just the covariant divergence of N. So delta K is delta of div N. And so I have two components to that. I've got the divergence of delta N, and I've got the change in the connection. So the first term, I replace my delta N with N dot delta G. And then the second term is just a half times the normal derivative of the trace of delta G. So then the last term is just a covariant derivative of n, and I can rewrite that as KAB. So putting this together, I can see that if I have a boundary term, which is the integral of root hk, I can subtract off the piece that I didn't like in that original variation. So when I take the variation of my full corrected action, the terms involving the normal derivatives of delta G from the variation of the bulk action are cancelled by the boundary variation of delta K that we saw just up there in the middle board. And then what's left over? Well, what's left over is this KAB piece here, and then a minus K HAB piece that comes from the variation of det of H. So this now is fine. if I do my variational principle, I would say my delta H was zero, and therefore my boundary term now safely vanishes. So I simply have my bulk Einstein equations, bulk Einstein equation term. So I've gone back, I've solved the problem that I set up, and also the other thing that you just notice is if we were allowing, if we were kind of going a little bit beyond the variational principle and saying we were allowing for a dynamical boundary, which would mean we would allow delta H to be non-zero, what I see is I get now this sort of, it's a bit like an Einstein tensor. I've got this term on the boundary. It tells me if I have a dynamical boundary, I have to add boundary pieces to the action that look like energy momentum or, you know, properties, physical properties of the boundary. So the way I've set this up, when we, if we want to think about doing dynamics of codimension one submanifolds, we kind of know what our Einstein equations are going to be. We've got an Einstein equation in the bulk, and we've got a boundary Einstein equation. So that's a good point to stop.